Welcome everyone to History in Technicolor, and here is me, David, and...
Me, Wolf.
Perfect, two me's. So, this week, Wolf, we are going to do Braveheart.
Yes.
Have you heard of it?
I have. It's a pretty popular movie.
Ask me why.
Why have you selected this movie for us to...
Right, because it's almost impossible not to, isn't it? I mean, you cannot talk about history movies without coming across Braveheart, can you?
Well, we kind of wanted to not do it.
Did we? Oh dear. So, because I had to, and secondly, because I've just done Wallace and the History of Scotland, so I am very interested to see how the film compared to what I now know about its history. Before I tell you about it, because I'm going to tell you about it, at some length, actually.
Yes, I'm prepared.
You are prepared. Have you got your pillow? There are some confessions I need to make. Confessions of bias. So, I'm a patriotic Englishman, and I have seen bits of it. I haven't seen the whole thing. But also, a bit like giving somebody a trial, I've had so many, seen so many opinions of it that it's almost impossible to come to it very fresh. So, I make my declaration there, okay?
Fine. How many times do you think you've seen the film?
Oh, it's the first time I've seen it, end to end.
Really?
Oh, for sure, yeah. Absolutely. I avoided the time. I thought, do I want to sit there? No.
Wait, this can't
really
be...
simple.
You must be lying, right?
No, I've seen the end.
You've
bit.
Never watched Braveheart.
I've seen Freedom. Seen
You've never bit. Watched Braveheart.
No, why would I
I don't even
do
particularly
that?
Like the movie, and I've seen it four or five times.
Why would I want to see it?
Well, we'll go through and we'll talk about that. I did not come here to defend this movie, but I feel that
you came to bury it.
I don't know what you're doing, having never watched it. It's been around for 23 years.
Yeah. Very easy to avoid.
And it won 5 Oscars and you just didn't watch it.
You know the one coming out with Chris Pine on Netflix about Robert Bruce that we've just been talking about?
Yes.
I'm never going to watch that either, okay?
What happens if it's good?
I don't care.
Okay.
It's a bit of art I'm going to miss. There's plenty of art in the world. I don't need to see that bit of it, okay?
Okay.
So, 1995, directed by Mel Gibson, nominated for 10 awards, and it won, I'm going to say incredibly, 5. Best Picture, Best Director, Best Cinematography, Best Makeup, and Best Sound Editing. It's one of those films which is rated even higher by audiences than critics, even though critics liked it quite a lot. Metacritic is as low as 68%, audiences 85%. It is, ironically, a film about Scotland, directed by an Australian, shot mainly in Ireland, although there are bits in Scotland too. And as I think you might have mentioned to me, most of the actors are...
Well, they're from all over
English,
the place.
Australian, whatever as well. Anyway, and Scots. It is 3 hours long.
Yes.
Can you say that again? It's 3 hours long. Why didn't you tell me?
I thought you'd seen the movie.
I did 3 hours long.
I thought you knew what you were doing. This is going to confuse me for a long time.
I resent it. So do I need to tell you the story? I think I probably do. Well, I'm going to anyway. 13th century Scotland, First War of Independence. Edward I, the French-speaking medieval king who happened to hold lands in France, Wales, Ireland and, oh, England. Did I mention England? Wallace's family, his father is brutally killed, but yet he is a man of peace. Until his squeeze has her throat cut and he takes the fight to the English for revenge and for freedom of his homeland. He wins a bunch of stuff, loses a bunch of stuff in ways that is clearly never his fault, okay? He is betrayed by his own side and, oh, Edward I is a nasty man and he cheats. Would you believe it? Edward I cheats in battle. What an outrage. Cheats the Norsemen. Can't trust these Frenches, you see. Wallace ends up being eviscerated in the traditional manner for treason, cheating the French-speaking medieval king as he lays dying, watching, by shouting, "Freedom!" with his last breath. Did you see the clip that I showed you, the joke?
I sadly did.
You did? You sadly did. It was a video Robin, I think, put it up on the Facebook site, Robin Schwartz. I thought it was very funny. And I thought it kind of typified me for the way that this movie has become ingrained in the public consciousness. Because the gag about the Scottish-speaking lift ends with them standing on top of each other shouting, "Freedom!"
I did appreciate that, but I felt it was almost as long as Braveheart itself for a sketch. So I kind of passed that partway
through. Is that right? I really like the sketch, actually. Anyway, but there you go. So should we talk very briefly about the real historical background? I prepared this. I'm going to be brief, even though, you know, you might be already slightly bored. Scotland has a fascinating history, as I'm sure you know, with Norse, Gaelic, English, Brythonic, so that's Celtic, but speaking a different kind of language, or different form of the language, all those different traditions. At the start of the 13th century, it is a largely integrated kingdom, integrated in the sense that it owes allegiance to one king, the Canmores. Alexander III dies in 1286 after a horrendously series of bad luck. I mean, really bad luck. He's got loads of kids, everything's fine, they all die, and he falls off the top of a cliff, racing home to meet his new bride who's going to produce him some new kids. Really unlucky, you know. So Edward I, being a respected king, is asked to help the Scots select a successor, which he does in a perfectly fair process, actually, although with one very unfair part of it, and that Edward I makes every candidate for the role of the new king to swear to pay homage to him, which is the big thing that Edward I does, which causes all the problems later, or many of the problems later with Scotland and England. Anyway.
Why was he called Longshanks?
Because he had long legs.
I see. Okay.
The process is perfectly fair and well done, actually. He makes a bit of a meal of it, but in the end, John Balliol is selected by Edward I, and everybody agrees, actually, that John Balliol is the right guy. Robert the Bruce is a bit cross about it, but Balliol has the better claim. John Balliol is known to the world, or known to the Scots in particular, as Tomb Tabard, Empty Vest, because he has a really bad reputation as somebody who just pays the English king homage and is without honour. John Balliol is one of the most unfairly dealt with figures in Scottish history, in my view. Perfectly honourable man, does his best, gets hammered by Edward. He does his best to bring the Scottish realm together to rebel against Edward, which he does, actually. Wallace enters the story. He's a bona fide hero, is our Wallace. He actually, although constantly people say we don't know much about him, we know a fair amount about him, especially for somebody who's from that long ago. He's probably a knight. He leads a revolt from the borders, guerrilla warfare. He's viewed at the time with deep suspicion by the traditional nobility of Scotland, who are themselves divided between those that support Edward as their recognised liege lord and those who don't. Wallace wins Stirling Bridge, he's made a guardian, he then loses at Falkirk, he resigns like Cincinnatus, doesn't go back to his plough though, he goes back to guerrilla warfare, he's eventually betrayed and captured.
Who betrays him?
I've forgotten his name, but his valet, his man, as it were, paid off by the English and for some reason doesn't like Wallace any. The sources about Wallace are various. They don't start until the late 14th century, so about, 70, 80 years after the events. And they're of three kinds. So you've got English chroniclers all hate him and think he's a despoiler of churches and a raper of nuns and all the rest of it. Brucean. So people who have become chroniclers after Bruce has become king. And therefore the story is about Bruce and how great he is, because Bruce is king and his descendants are king. So you don't diss him. And therefore Wallace's role is downplayed by those folks. And then you get Blind Harry, who's a 15th century. Blind Harry, he's a chronicler, and he's a bard, and he's called Blind Harry. I mean, that's
fantastic.
Sounds like
the guy who fixed my car.
Is that right? I think that's brilliant positioning for a bard, Blind Harry. I mean, that's fantastic, isn't it? Blind Harry shall sing. Blind Harry comes forward. He's blind. He's got his lyre. He's in the hall of the Lord. Fantastic positioning. He'd probably see perfectly well, but, called himself Blind Harry. Anyway, Blind Harry writes a fantastic romantic novel kind of thing, which really bigs up Wallace, because Blind Harry is writing at the time of James III, a Scottish king who is favourable to the English. Blind Harry doesn't like this, so he writes a book which is anti-English, and he chooses Wallace as his hero. And Bruce is a compromised figure, because Bruce plays with the English.
Okay.
Wallace becomes a hero in Scotland, especially in the days of Robbie Burns and Walter Scott, because he's uncompromised, as I say, unlike Bruce. Wallace is a straightforward guy who supports his king, John Balliol, and fights against anybody who is against his king. There is a poem that we were going to sing together, we were going to talk together, okay? We're going to do this. This is by Robbie Burns, and Robbie Burns is inspired, says very early in his life that he is inspired by Wallace and Hannibal, interesting enough. Are we ready? Scots, why high we Wallace bled. Shall we start now?
Yeah, I'm kidding.
Come on, let's stitch Davy's version in instead. Over to Davy, and one he prepared earlier.
Scots wha hae wi Wallace bled, Scots wha Ambrose has aften led, welcome to your glory bed, or to victory. Now's the day, and now's the hour. See the front of battle lower, see approach proud Edward's power, chains and slavery. Wha will be a traitor knave, wha can fill a coward's grave, wha say best to be a slave, let him turn and flee. Wha for Scotland's king and law, freedom's sword, will strongly draw, freemen stand or freemen fall, let him follow me. By oppressions, woes and pains, by your sons and several chains, we will drain our dearest veins, but they shall be free. Lay proud, usurpers low, tyrants fall in every foe, liberties in every blow, let us do or die.
You get the idea. A poem that actually almost became a national anthem for a while is still very well known. The point I'm making is that Wallace is a bona fide hero with a real history in what is a very complicated time.
So Wallace was always a hero? Or did he become more of a hero?
Wallace was always a hero. The people he was least of a hero to, funnily enough, well, he wasn't a hero to the English, obviously, he was the enemy of the English, but within Scotland, the people he was least favoured by are the magnates. Because the Scottish magnates are used to running the shop. And that's what this debate is about, in fact. It's about whether their rights and the laws and customs of Scotland will be respected by Edward I or not. And they don't trust Edward, quite rightly in my view, to do so. And that's why they begin to drain away from supporting Edward and towards fighting him. But Wallace is NQOCD, not quite our class, darling. His gentry, or maybe even a commoner. We don't know the answer to that question.
Okay.
So they don't like the fact that he's being successful, because he's not a proper magnate. Okay, so the film. Well, no, I'm going to start with historical accuracy. Is that acceptable?
Go ahead.
Because what I want to say about this is we could spend the rest of my life, certainly, possibly even yours, even though you're hardly born, you know, just talking about the inaccuracies. So it is better to say what is accurate. Take my word for it. This is the most inaccurate historical movie you will ever go and see. Any other movie this inaccurate would say at the beginning, this is just fiction. I have the honesty to say that. This film does not have the honesty to say that. It is just not accurate. And I'll come back to a little bit later, but it's inaccurate in silly ways. Wolf, sorry, I'm beginning to rant, aren't I? And this will continue.
No, I have a lot of things that I do want to ask, and I want to find out what is accurate and okay. What isn't in many ways.
Well, it's just all inaccurate. You start with the basis that it's all tripe, okay? That is the only word that is applicable to the historical accuracy is tripe. I will tell you the things that are true. As an example, it starts off in 1280 and says that Scotland has had no freedom. That is tripe. Alexander III dies in 1286, not 1280. Why do they lie about that in the movie? Why would you do that? It's just so coruscatingly, cascadingly, volcanically stupid to lie about
that. Quite stupid.
Or reasonably stupid. Why were they that stupid? Why, Wolf? I need an answer, and I need it now.
Entertainment.
They're 1280. Just make it 1286. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Yes.
I take the point about entertainment being the job of people making films. It'd be good to come back to that at the end. Fair enough. Why lie about things you don't have to lie about? No dramatic purpose. So that's just one example of the level of inaccuracy, and I will say no more. So there are some truths in this movie. There were wars in Scotland, which ended up in being a battle between the nobility and people of Scotland, well, mainly the nobility of Scotland and Edward I. There is a man called Wallace, and he fought for the rights of John Balliol, although they never say that in the film, actually, but against Edward I. And actually, as I say, Wallace's dedication to the hated Tomb Tabard is an inconvenient fact. He fights in the name of John Balliol all the way through his life. And he never, for example, supports Robert Bruce as king. He works with him, fine, not as a problem. As a magnate, he never supports him as a king, because the Duke, rightful king, is John Balliol. The film does include something of the split in the Scottish nobility, that they held land both from Edward and from the Scottish crown, and therefore their position was very compromised. The figure of Robert the Bruce and his father, so Bruce's father, what they decide to do, actually, is Robert the Bruce's dad says, right, I'll hold the lands in England from Edward, and I'll support Edward, and you, son, you can have all the lands in Scotland, and you can do as you will. That's how they resolve it. He was never a leper.
Okay.
Why was he a leper in the film?
I don't know.
Wolf, why was he a leper? Tell me now. I suppose to show his corruption, I suppose, actually. There's a dramatic device, isn't there? Yeah, fine, fair enough. He should have been a leper. Damn that he wasn't a leper in real life. Anyway. Sorry, I'm ranting again.
Keep going.
So it does cover that, actually, which is good. Fine. So Wallace is executed. And he is executed. And quite rightly, at his trial, actually, he makes the point in the film that he can't be executed for treason because he's never sworn allegiance to Edward, which is absolutely right and actually happens. Unlike the rest of Scotland, incidentally, who had sworn allegiance to Edward I on the famous, infamous Ragman's Roll. Wallace is presented in the film as the leader of the common man. This is a tradition which is deeply doubted by historians, but actually can't be disproved. And Wallace, as we've said, is certainly not of the magnate class who are used to ruling Scotland politically. So he is, to a degree, even if he's a knight and gentry, he is, to a degree, an outsider. And that tradition of him leading the common man, whereas the magnates sort of full compromise, well, you can't actually disprove it. So it could be true. The film presents Wallace as a very brutal man, as well as a brave and determined leader. It overdoes the brutality, in my view. But Wallace was an impressive leader. He did what he needed to do. He burns the Bishop of Glasgow's lands at one stage, which oddly doesn't appear in the film, but he burns the Bishop of Glasgow's lands because Glasgow, the bishop at that point, normally a doughty fighter for Scottish freedom, actually, has sworn allegiance to Edward, because people tend to go backwards and forwards in this. And so he burns his land to bring him to light. He does what he needs to do. And in that, there's some accuracy in the film in that it doesn't present Wallace as a powder puff, a sort of, you know, it shows him doing brutal things. Everything else
so it just
is tripe.
Do we know if Wallace tripe. Knew French and Latin?
We don't know about that, but we do know he goes, after the defeat of Falkirk, he goes to the court of Philip VI. And at the beginning, at the start of it, Philip VI is, he actually writes to Edward and says, look, I've got this bloke called Wallace here. Do you want me to kill him and send him back, his head back to you, or, you know, whatever, or do you want to put him in chains? And Edward says, no, just put him in prison. By the end of his visit, Wallace has persuaded King Philip to write to the Pope in defence of Scottish claims. So I don't know if he can speak those languages, you don't know that, but we do know he's not a brute. He's a intelligent, varied, skilled leader and diplomat. Okay, the timing of this city, the Bruce family, the dress, the hairstyles, the battles, the locations, they're all tripe. I mean, there is a battle at Stirling Bridge, but in the film, did you notice one thing about the battle at Stirling Bridge in the film?
I'm going to say no.
There's no bridge.
Oh.
The clue's in the name.
It's just over the hill.
Why? Anyway, the worst bit of inaccuracy, though, it's supposedly shot in the Highlands, although I'll come back to that later. Where are the midges?
Ah, yes.
Where are the midges? You know, clearly Wallace had been wandering around saying, ow, bloody hell, wiping his, trying to get rid of the cloud of midges, and you do not see a single midge in the film, do you?
Well, I can never watch this film again.
No, absolutely.
You've pointed that out. What's
roll the theme music.
Take back those five Oscars.
So, for accuracy, we'll have the conversation later at the allotted time, of course, but it scores well into the minus 4,000s, okay?
Okay, yes. Okay.
You might want to argue, obviously.
I do have one to ask.
Yes.
Did the Irish come and help?
No.
Okay. In any...
No. Absolute tripe. In 1315, once Bruce has come to the throne and actually established de facto, though not yet de jure, in his position on the throne, his brother Edward invades Ireland. He gets war there, which he loses eventually, although there's a close-run thing for a while, and the Irish divide 50-50 between English and Edward, and actually eventually they swap sides and kick Edward out. So the film, so this is where I have a real problem, because I looked at all the reviews and it really catches people's imagination, doesn't it? People love it, don't they?
So what did you think of it?
Yes, that's the problem. So it was impossible for me to judge this film fairly, because
you've never watched it before. Which doesn't make any sense.
Why does it not make any sense? How many times have you watched A Man for All Seasons?
One.
Mm-mm, once. How can you not have watched it a million times?
Well, the movie didn't come out in the cinema while I was alive.
Okay.
So that is one factor.
That is.
This movie came out, had a massive marketing campaign.
How can you be
campaign.
So young? It's unacceptable. Anyway, sorry.
Everybody
right.
watched this movie. People went out to the local cinemas to go watch this movie in 1995 because it was such a big deal.
Yeah.
It's like when Gladiator came out and everybody went and watched Gladiator.
Yeah. I had better things to do with my life. I had paint to watch drying.
I don't know how you didn't end up seeing it once. back then. Anyway, if you had, I'd be very intrigued to see how your opinion had changed.
It would, but sadly not. Sadly no, can't.
But you've let me down.
I have let you down. I'd have hated it then.
So you didn't enjoy it?
Well, no, that's too simple a thing to say. So I can see many positive things about it. One of my main problems was that I find Mel Gibson unbearable in a visceral sense. So every time I was looking at this hero, I was thinking, it was doing nothing for me.
Was it his accent?
It's his face.
Yes.
And that, something like that's not Mel's fault. That is clearly, probably not my fault.
It's probably Mel's fault.
Probably Mel's. Let's blame Mel.
All of our problems with this movie are because of Mel Gibson. We actually do know that that's because of Mel Gibson.
Anyway, the point is, if this was, I found it a mix of Highlander, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and Gladiator. I kept on thinking of Christopher Lambert and expecting him to see him turn up in a 1980s trench coat or see Sean Connery. Have you seen Highlander?
Yes, many times.
Oh, it's a great movie, isn't it? Anyway, I kept on it just had that feel about it. All the mud hut things, felt like that.
There can be only one.
Actually, they were better because they had the sort of Pictish towers, even though the date was all wrong. But anyway, Robin Hood is a bit like Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, but without the humour. Mel Gibson cannot do humour, can he? But the Lethal Weapon is supposed to be really good, isn't it? But he did these really clunky sort of eye rolls at various times. Or once he was chucking a bit of rock after it, and he could hardly catch the rock. And he kept on looking at the rock as he chucked it, and he was supposed to be all nonchalant. And I was thinking, just give me Errol Flynn. Give me him now.
I tell you what's weird. He keeps doing these deranged
eyes. Yes, I think.
I wish anyone could see these.
Yes.
He'll, lean in and go...
Yes.
Ah. And he'll... He looks like he's in, a 1930s horror movie.
Yeah. and he's supposed to be doing that sort of slightly ironic, isn't this guy being funny,
he's Boris situation. Karloff or something.
Absolutely. And he's looking like a madman. Yeah, absolutely right. Anyway, and Gladiator, actually, does anybody think, would I be quite out of line to say this film must have influenced Gladiator? The music and the trope, which I really liked actually about it, of the, as he lays dying, he sees his murdered wife appear in the crowd, which actually I found very touching, and I rather liked about Gladiator, actually. It's a bit melodramatic and all the rest of it, but I really liked it.
I think any similarities are to do with, obviously, this movie was really successful. Mm. It's the kind of, I don't know, just it all comes together. You can see that they probably looked at it.
Yeah.
Even if nothing else, as a business model.
Yeah.
I thought what works.
Right. So I thought the music and that thing, the thing with the wife, I thought reminded me of Gladiator.
I mean, technically, it's really good.
Right.
The cinematography, which obviously it won for, it looks really good. The battle scenes are really good. Mm-hmm. It must have been challenging to make.
There are some good things, okay. The Buckle is without doubt swashed. There's lots of action, things going on. It's great action scenes, doesn't slide away from brutality. I think maybe overdoes it a little bit, there's lots of it, but that's great. There's heroic escapes, all the rest. It does all that really well, I think. The death scene is brilliant. I mean, it's horribly cheesy. Freedom! But it worked really well as an act of, a hero against a bunch of villains. I thought it's deservedly iconic. Edward I is brilliant. I loved Edward I. A real hammed-up villain, Patrick McGoohan. The bit I enjoyed most of the film.
When he throws the man out the window.
So good. That was just very, very funny. But it would have worked really well in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, because it would have been funny.
And it would have been Alan Rickman.
And it would have been Alan Rickman, who can do humour. Anyway, so, I thought it was great. Brendan Gleeson, I could watch anything with Brendan Gleeson. He's an absolute genius, and everything he was in. There was a rock-throwing game, which could have been really rubbish, actually. Brendan Gleeson does it really well. Actually, Mel does that scene quite well. It's one of my favourite bits in it. The cinematography you mentioned, I'm not an expert. I don't know about these things. All I can say is it looked fantastic.
And there's that really great shot where the small band of them running, almost feels like a Lord of the Rings image, where it's kind of running over the landscape. Obviously, they're setting off to go where they need to go.
Yeah.
But as it just pans out, this small group of men kind of disappears more and more into the landscape.
Ah, brilliant, yeah.
As they keep running.
It is really good. And, it's got to be said, they're working with great material. All you have to do is really point a camera at the Scottish Highlands and you're in.
You go do it then, David.
Yeah. fair enough. Yes, no, I accept the point. The soundtrack is brilliant. It feels fantastic. The music is really good. Cheesy, but good. You know, it does the job, I think. And there are some great lines in it. You know, they can take our lives, but they can never take our freedom. I mean, that's very good, isn't it? They use a very line, the famous line, which I think... it's not in this poem, but it might be another one that we use. You have bled with Wallace, now bleed with me. Bruce uses it. That's a very famous line. I think it's from Blind Harry, but it could be wrong. So there are some good things in it. What did you think of the good things?
Obviously, I watched it like 20 years ago. The movie definitely had an impact when I first watched it, and for a few times afterwards, because it's made so well, the fight scenes are so exciting, it has everything you want in that sense. You're completely on his side. Mm. And then you just get to watch him... usually get one over on everyone.
Yeah.
If they get one over on him, he kills them. And then even when, like, he dies at the end, you still feel like he won.
Yeah.
And you're a bit like, okay, great, yes, yeah, stick it to them. I have fond memories of it. Watching it again, very hard. The 3 hours felt like 6 hours.
Right.
Especially the build-up.
Is that because you've changed, Wolf? Would you like to lie down and I'll...
Let me tell you about my relationship with my mother.
Please don't tell me about your relationship with your mother. Yes, anyway.
It's too long.
Mm.
It's too silly. It's too Hollywoodized. Mm. It's too cliched throughout. In one thing, obviously, like the pantomime villain, there are just things where I'm like, well, this is awful, but I'm not really like connected with this and outraged by it because I just don't believe it. The main thing for me is when I watch it now... the whole build-up and the romance... Right. The romance only for the purpose...
The romance.
...that she can be murdered just to really embolden him against the English.
Yeah.
It's frustrating.
The love scenes, I thought, were pitiful. I mean, she'd have called the police, wouldn't she? He's too old and gnarled and hammy. I thought the love scenes were pitiful.
It still works because you're conditioned for it to work, to some extent, by everything you've ever watched. Yes. The music is playing at the same time. Everything is building up. So you're told, like, this is the bit in Shrek where he holds up the sign and says, applause or be sad. Like, that's... So you're told an emotional response to have. I just think, for me, a lot of the writing is relatively lazy.
It reminded me also a bit of, on that theme, actually, a bit of War Horse. Do you remember the Steven Spielberg War Horse thing?
Terrible movie.
Terrible, terrible movie. And at one stage, he's digging in the Devon Fields or something, and there's this incredible orange sky behind him. And you just think, how stupid do you think I am? How manipulable do you think I am, Steven, to put that image up? I'm not going to be manipulated. You know, on your bike. And a little bit, some of it reminded me of that. I don't want to be manipulated in this way. There you go. Freedom. Freedom! It's far too long. It's clearly been sponsored by the Ramblers Association. That was sort of a gag.
And a good one.
Thank you, thank you. So much cheese, I may have to become vegan to get over it.
Another great
gag. Another great gag, yeah. I couldn't turn off the inaccuracy. I tried. But I couldn't. Just annoyed me too much, so I could never really give it justice. Which helps me segue, actually, into the first of my... What are the important things about this movie, to me? And one is, it puts Scotland on the map in a major way. There are lots of reviews on the website. People going to Thailand, and people say, oh, yes, I've seen Braveheart. You know, I know something of the history of Scotland. Although, of course, they don't. But, I mean, it does that in spades, isn't it? It puts Scotland and its amazing history on the map.
And it's a very positive...
Yeah.
Depiction Absolutely. Of Scotland, which is great.
So other things I thought were important about the film, the Highland thing, I'm going to get into trouble for this. I'm quoting Scottish historians when I say that it is part of the tradition of Gael washing of Scottish history. Wallace was a man of the borders. When he goes back after his defeat at Falkirk, he fights from Selkirk Forest. He is made guardian in the church of the forest in Selkirk, which is in the borders. Henry and I went walking there, and we came across it. We didn't know, expect it, and it's still there, this little church. It hasn't got a roof. It's really atmospheric. You can imagine what it would have been like for Wallace, the made guardian of Scotland, this sort of man from gentry at most. This is all about the Highlands. They're talking about the Highlands. The Highlands were a very small part of what happened. They are involved to a degree. All of Lowland history is subverted by this idea of the Highlands. And if I was a Scotch, I'm not, so it's not my problem, I would find it irritating.
Is it easier, just if you're going to present this image to everybody in the world, to
reinforce that old stereotype? Yeah, it is. So fair enough. Okay, next one. This is such a wasted opportunity. The Wars of Independence are genuinely fascinating. there is an amazing story to be told that does not require this black and white, good guy, bad guy stuff. And a filmmaker of some skill could have made just as compelling a story out of that, that would have got people just as exciting rather than this.
Now, I agree, but I am just going to throw this out there. This movie was beyond successful.
Yes.
It's clearly given everybody what they wanted.
So what you're saying essentially is its success as a piece of art justifies its dishonesty. There are people who believe this is what happened. So there will be people in the world who think this is the way Scotland was. That is not the history. Is it? What I'm saying is, why not make a good movie that is honest?
Yeah, I mean, I do agree. I do think it can be better. I do think it can aspire to be better.
Mm.
And I do think that just saying, because it's really successful, doesn't mean that it's good. I think that I'm just saying that it's possible that the movie that you want would not necessarily, in some terms, be a better movie. Just to throw something else out there, how much of Wallace's life do we not know?
It's quite a lot we don't know, but we know plenty of Wallace. You could build the character. There are times when people change stuff. I think this is the art of the historical novelist. And it seems to me that historical novelists have a big part to play in our understanding of history because they can do things historians can't. They can speculate and they can put mood and colour around characters. And as long as they're playing to the rules, where they're either doing things which are realistic and credible and possible and made clear changes to chronology or whatever for the sake of entertainment, that is absolutely fine. This film lies constantly and knowingly. 1280, not 1286. Why? No bridge at Stirling Bridge. A whole load of stuff we know didn't happen. So it's not that he tries to build colour around Wallace. He says, I'm going to manipulate the world into creating a movie that people will love, and I'm going to pass it off as history. It's a lie.
We're all coming back to, and this is always going to be, this is going to happen. Like I say, they're not historians. They're not trying to tell history.
No.
That's not their goal. It really depends on the individual as to how much they care about historical accuracy. I think what we've clearly got here is a team that thinks that Wallace is fascinating, thinks that the story is fascinating, and then just pieces stuff together. And maybe doesn't even know all of it because they can see that the movie that they want to make.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to agree with you. And I think this is the interesting debate. It'd be very interesting to have on Facebook. I think this goes further. They don't just tweet things to make it entertaining. It's a nonsense. What they should have done is make it fiction, and then it would have been a great story. But they don't do that because that wouldn't have been commercially successful. They want to grab people of Scottish ancestry in Scotland and around the world and tie them into that story.
Do you think that this movie has helped increase tourism to Scotland?
Yeah, I mean, it's done a massive amount for Scotland, it's true. So there's no doubt people have come, they've seen the fantastic scenery. I mean, everybody would agree, I think, with that. And it's put Scotland on the map, as we were saying. So it's, in that, it has done great good, yes. It'd be quite interesting to see what people think on the Facebook site about, you know, is it okay for filmmakers to play with history as they wish, or do they have some kind of responsibility to keep some line of truth in it? It'd be quite interesting to see what people think.
The only thing that I would throw out there is, does anyone actually believe what happens in this film is real? Because I feel like, even just in casual conversation, people openly admit, even when they say they like the movie, that they know that it's made up.
I think there is quite a lot of awareness, but I'm not prepared to accept that filmmakers have no responsibility to historical accuracy. I'm prepared to accept that they're going to take liberties and their main responsibility is to entertain. I think they also have some responsible towards historical accuracy, and I think if they're good, the two are just not mutually incompatible. It's not a, it's a false dichotomy to say that either you can entertain or you can be accurate.
And do you think that this movie is one that is using the, like, the cloak of historical truth to, like, in, like, an aid?
Yes.
And that it's being deliberately misleading?
Yes.
As opposed to recognising that it doesn't follow history?
Yeah.
And is loosely inspired by?
Yeah.
And then it's just being fun?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then, yeah, it, obviously, if that's the way you found it, that probably is how I feel, to be honest.
Right.
Then it does make it worse.
Yeah. Anyway, that's a debate we can have on Facebook.
Glad you watched it?
I don't know, it's a good question.
Has it been bugging you that you've never watched it?
No, it hasn't been eating me up that I haven't seen Braveheart. But I did think this was a nice opportunity since I'd done the history bit.
And do you feel that even though you think it's tripe, that you're glad you've seen this piece of tripe finally?
Yeah, and I should be clear that I did say there are loads of positive things about the movie earlier, and I do mean that, actually. There were things about it, but...
So it's chocolate-covered tripe.
Chocolate-covered tripe. Nice.
Do you think if you had watched it when you were...
I'd have hated it
younger?
10 times more.
Really?
But I can absolutely understand the appeal of it, yeah. And because, you know, the basics are all there. It's got good and bad, light and dark. It's got heroics, as we said earlier. I absolutely understand why people love this movie.
Why would you recommend anyone watch it?
Why do I? Because of all those things. If you go into it knowing that it's historically just not accurate and you just want to enjoy it, enjoy a really swashbuckling movie, then this is a brilliant movie. And if you want to see the glory of Scottish countryside without midges, it's superb.
And if you want to see a very big man throw a very big sword very, very,
very
far
hard.
And then land perfectly with a nice little wobble.
Yeah. And if you want to see a perfect pantomime villain in Edward I, brilliantly paid, then equally fantastic. Okay, so let's rate it. Quality of the film.
I maybe would have rated it higher before. I'm not really that into it now. So I'd probably say 6 if I really balance.
Okay, six it is then. And historical accuracy.
I'll follow you on this, David.
So it's -4,000 then. I'd go, you know, there are some very, very basic things which are there, but it's a one, isn't it?
Probably what we're saying. What, people, places?
There are
roughly correct.
No, people, places wrong. I mean, there are people.
Are the battles
some
correct?
People,
do they?
The battles exist, they're done incorrectly. There's no Skiltrons at Falkirk. I mean, the Met battles bear no relation to what actually happened. There is one thing. Falkirk, the Scottish cavalry flees. And there have been implicate suggestions of betrayal. But it's Comyn, John Comyn the Red, who led the cavalry, not Bruce. Bruce was fighting on the English side at the time. Or probably fighting on the English side at the time. For Edward.
Okay, so it's all completely wrong.
It's utter tripe.
So we're saying one?
It's one.
Okay.
And it should be, it would be a nought if it wasn't the fact there was a chap called Wallace and there was somebody called Edward I.
And Scotland is a real place.
And Scotland is a real place.
Okay, yes, I'm happy with that.
Okay. All right. Okay, so social media, the discussion from Charge of the Light Brigade. Okay, Facebook discussion from the past, but done after Braveheart. It's a temporal shift. I find it very difficult to deal with. But Charge of the Light Brigade, then, that's what we're talking about. Bit of a change of pace after the first four movies where we'd sort of picked incredibly popular and successful movies to something in Charge, much less well known, a satirical anti-war movie. It was great to hear for some real enthusiasts for the movie. We had a great discussion with John, who drew attention particularly to that set piece at the end of the movie, the Charge itself, and we all agreed it was brilliantly done. And for John, one of his favourite ever battle sequences. Funnily enough, I find myself that the film was almost better in the discussing than it was in the watching. There were so many things to talk about. The really rather odd yet strangely brilliant animations were one of those things. John loved them, Steve hated them. I was a bit of both. Loved them, but just not embedded in that film. Kevin D made the point that the description of the charge and the communication leading up to it were very accurate. Kevin C made the point that if the recriminations at the end were amped up a bit, they entirely reflected both the anti-war point of the movie and the spirit of what happened after the charge when a whole lot of court cases or whatever happened. Yarmo. Now, Yarmo picked out some of the genuinely funny lines in the movie. The one he quoted was, "It will be a sad day for England when her armies are officered by men who know too well what they're doing and smacks of murder." Which is a delightful thing from Cardigan, I think it was. A delightful hack at the English glorification of the amateur and of class. And Tina felt, I think, that Wolf and I could have indulged ourselves with a little bit more mockery of Raglan and Cardigan. Darn. Fine opportunity missed. Wolf, though, did get in a few washins, to be fair. I enjoyed the debate as always. Great to see Alan, William and Jonathan and June going at it hammer and tongs. But actually, I love Alan's other point that we need to see the film in context of the time, the Vietnam War, and films like Oh, What a Lovely War. Oh, and if there's one New Year's resolution that came out of it all, it was to give Errol Flynn a go at his version of it. Maybe. Do you know, just don't do Errol. But maybe, since someone else mentioned Captain Blood, and that's by my father's favourite author, Raphael Sabatini, so maybe I'll make that one. give that one a go. Numbers-wise, over 60% of you who completed the poll hadn't seen it. Most of you saying that you'd be interested, some of you not. And we'd love to hear from any of you who did get around to watching it after the debate. For those of you who had seen it, about half of you loved it. The rest of you, it's more a question of finding it interesting than loving it. Anyway, brilliant debate as always. Thanks so much for taking part. Okay, great. So that was the roundup from last time. So, Wolf, what questions do you have for listeners?
Have we been too harsh on Mel Gibson and Braveheart, or have we been far too lenient?
Far too
on
lenient.
This piece of tripe.
Far too lenient. All right. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. I'd like to formally apologise for the ranting. Thank you very much, everybody. And
thank you and goodbye.
Are you not entertained?